schedule yet for Friday and Monday?
Well, let's get on with it.
Good morning. It is now 9:15 a.m. We are here today, September 15, 2016, in the OPA Hearing Room, Suite 907 of the DNA Building in Hagatna, Guam, for the formal hearing continuation of OPA PA 16-007 and 16-011, Cartech International Court versus Department of Public Works. Presiding over the hearing today is Public Auditor Doris Flores Brooks and Hearing Officer Anthony Camacho. For the record, also present from the Office of Public Accountability are Rodlyn Gerardo and Jarek Hernandez. Will Appellant Cortec please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning. Joyce Tang and Leslie Travis for Cortec. With me is Mr. Ho Yun, who is the chairman of Cortec and institutional representative. Throughout the proceedings, another Cortec employee has also been present, Mr. Henry Titanelli. I don't think that's been an issue. We have not identified him as an institutional representative, but to the extent that that needs to be done, we do so now.
Thank you. Will purchasing agency DPW please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Yeah, Assistant Attorney General Tom Keeler, present for the Department of Public Works, is the Deputy Director, Mr. Benavente.
Thank you. Will interested party Guam Educational Facilities Foundation, Inc. please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning, Ike Agigi for Guam Educational Facilities Foundation. With me is Janlin Demian, co-counsel, and Mr. Richard Inman, president of the entity, as well as the institutional representative.
Thank you.
Excuse me, if I might. I'm sorry, I was expecting my co-attorney generals to identify themselves. Present.
Go ahead.
Present is Deputy Attorney General Ken Orcutt. Also present is Assistant Attorney General Shannon Titanel.
But my understanding was Mr. Orcutt had a limited presence today for the purpose of his motion to quash. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and I was going to, we'll address that in a minute or two. Yes, that is one of the things we'll address first.
Thank you.
Before we got on record, I had this hearing officer brief this logistical discussion with the parties, as today we're in the OPA conference room, which is much smaller than the sixth floor DISID conference room. So I had to quickly clear out some witnesses just so that there'd be sufficient room and have the legal number of people in the room that's required. And as a result, Mr. Benavente is sitting in the witness stand. Mr. Romero, who did appear for his subpoena, has been moved to the OPA conference room. Mr. Fernandez, who did appear pursuant to his subpoena and his instruction, was further instructed or released for this morning and instructed to come back at 2 o'clock p.m. I had a discussion with the parties concerning the order of witnesses today, and essentially we're going to finish with Mr. Benavente, which is, I informed the parties, would be one of my priorities. This is the third day of Mr. Benavente's examination. And according to Ms. Tang, the next witness would be Mr. Romero, and hopefully we'll get to Mr. Fernandez by today. Also discussed was Mr. Inman's testimony. He stated he would be leaving Highland on Saturday at 6 a.m., or this Saturday at 6 a.m., and instructed the parties that regardless of where we end today, essentially tomorrow morning at 9, we would start with Mr. Inman's testimony. I also advised Mr. Agigi, one of the counselors for GEF, that I would give him great leeway in his cross so that he might ask Mr. Inman some of the questions he'd otherwise ask during his direct examination. Was that a fair summation of the discussion we had off the record?
Yes.
Yes, I just
like to
leave
anything out? Well, we're going to get to other stuff, but Mr. But to answer my question, did I leave anything out? Just want to make sure.
Just to also clarify, the way we discussed with Ms. Tang was that she also indicated that she would be about an hour with Mr. Inman's questioning, because my whole intent was to also leave sufficient time for me to conduct my
exam. I understand, but I'm not going to hold the parties to their estimates. But I did make clear that for Mr. Inman's testimony, I would try very hard so that each party had a sufficient time, or at least an equal amount of time, to ask Mr. Inman their questions. Now, we have quite a few preliminary matters, and because Mr. Orcutt is actually here. He's typically not an attorney in this case. He's here because...
Can I request that matter be just put aside for a few minutes? We're actually following opposition. Our runner is in your window, and I'd like to get that in here.
Gonna have to take this up right now, Ms. Tang.
Okay.
And in terms of this motion to quash a subpoena for the Honorable Judith T. Wanpat, who is the Speaker of the Guam Legislature, this is your motion, Mr. Orcutt?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And this was filed 4 p.m. yesterday, so do all the parties have this motion?
Yes, we do.
Yes, okay. And when were you planning on calling Ms. Wanpat to the stand, Ms. Tang?
We had contacted Ms. Wanpat last week by letter, asking if she would make herself available on Thursday or Friday this week, and we did not receive the response. We did receive the motion to quash. So I was hoping to squeeze her in sometime today. It was going to be a brief one, and depending on her availability, we don't know her availability. So I'm happy to squeeze her in wherever we can, and based on her schedule.
Well, if she does appear, I'm going to give her great deference as to her schedule. And
yes.
She is one of the leading government figures, as argued correctly by Mr. Orcutt in his motion. Mr. Orcutt, on your motion?
Yes. Under the law, the proponent of the person, of getting the official's testimony at trial has the burden of satisfying several factors before it'd be proper for the high government official to testify. And the first one is testimonial knowledge. The government official must actually have something to say. In this case, we do not believe that Speaker Wanpat has anything to say. In her declaration, she indicated that she is a legislative official, not an executive branch official. She was not involved in the procurement process in this matter. She has nothing to add.
Well, Mr. Orcutt, before you continue, are you familiar with the appellant's exhibit number 8?
Is that the letter to the...
Yes.
Yeah, that's a letter.
Did you...
And that letter speaks for itself. And if it's relevant at all, and it's not proper, as I mentioned in the brief, to go into a legislator's intent or mind as to why certain legislation was passed or not.
Okay. Now, I know I've actually, between yesterday and today, looked at some of the cases you cite. One of the distinguishing factors I find in at least one of them, or two of them, because I just went through them briefly, so I don't know which one of the many you cite. But this is not a case where someone's called simply by virtue of their high position. This is a case where we actually have this letter which talks about this solicitation. And I do take issue with you because one of the issues is the funding cap, which this letter speaks directly to. Are you aware of the issue concerning the funding?
This is not a case I've been involved with.
Okay.
I think the point of the matter is that in her declaration, the speaker said she was not involved in any negotiations, any discussions. She knows nothing about any kind of collusion. She knows nothing about any kind of agreement to exceed the $100 million cap. I mean, she's basically testified. She's already informed this body as to what she would testify to. And what she has to testify to is basically, I don't know anything about this. So she has no testimonial knowledge. That's number one. It's speculation to say that she would. Number two, you also have to show that this, to call a high government official, you have to show that only she has this knowledge. And in this case, by definition, we're talking about an collusion, an agreement, some kind of deal that the proponent Kortek is saying occurred. In her declaration says, I don't know anything about this, but even if there was such a deal, there are more people that would know about it. By definition, agreement involves more than one person. Collusion involves more than one person. So she should call those witnesses. It would be totally premature when you have, what, 8 witnesses that she intends to call? The Kortek intends to call. It would be totally premature to say that the Speaker Wanpat, a high government official, should come in and basically say, I don't know anything about this, when there are other witnesses supposedly she has any case at all that would support her position that there was collusion. So they haven't met that element either. The third element is you have to show it's essential for Cortex's case. And that's something, because I don't know this case, I couldn't say what's essential or not. I don't know what she's arguing. But I would leave that up to the other parties to address. And the fourth burden that the proponent has that has not been met here is to show that Speaker Wompat is available to testify. Now, it's nice that they're today saying, you know, oh, we'll try to accommodate her schedule. But the reality is they did not call her. They did not submit any kind of, make any kind of effort to say, when are you available? And I've cited authority in the brief that shows that generally you don't get to call high government officials, in particular legislators. I mean, some states have constitutional amendments in them that say, you know, during a legislature's in session, or even, you know, with a time period outside that, in Wisconsin, you have like 15 days after the legislature is in session, that you can't even subpoena a legislature to testify.
But I don't think...
We don't have that provision.
Unfortunately, you are correct. I also tried to look that up real quick, and I think Missouri, for example, is a state that has something similar.
But I think that the fact that these statutes and constitutional provisions exist shows that there's a public policy against calling legislatures to court, especially, as say in this case, they have not come forth with any evidence of what they're going to ask this person, what they expect the evidence to be. They basically need to make an offer of proof to you as to why Speaker Wompat's testimony is necessary. I don't think they can do that. One of the cases I think that's particularly appropriate is for the court to look at is the Wazon versus Drew case, a federal rules of decision case that I cited at the end of my memorandum. And in that case, an employee that had been terminated from her employment sought to take the deposition of the Wisconsin governor and secretary of the Department of Administration, because she said there had been some kind of a deal made, just kind of like in this case, some kind of deal, some kind of collusion had occurred involving the governor and the Department of Administration for the state of Wisconsin that impacted her wrongful termination case. And not only did the court in that case say, and the only evidence that the proponent of the testimony had was that was some kind of hearsay evidence that some co-employee had said that the governor had entered into a secret deal. And the court in that case not only quashed the subpoena, but also imposed sanctions. You know, when I heard about this just yesterday, about this effort to take the testimony of Speaker Wompat, I remembered that the Charles Manson case, when that went to trial, Manson's attorneys tried to subpoena John Lennon to testify. And I think we're kind of on that end of the scale in this case, where, you know, just because you've got some kind of tangential relationship, a letter is all they've got in this case, does not mean you get to take that person's testimony. Speaker Wompat was not involved in this procurement. She had nothing to do with it. All she did was send a letter that speaks for itself. So the court should summarily quash this subpoena.
Thank you, Mr. Orcutt. Ms. Tang?
All right, thank you.
Well, hey, before we start, Mr. Keeler, any comments? Because I believe you side with Mr. Orcutt.
Correct. Okay. We would note that in support of the motion that, number one, the letter is addressed to Mr. Fernandez. Mr. Fernandez is available and can testify as to the reasons why the letter was requested and received. Number two, the public law, it's the plain language of the public law also references the additional financing that is available. It can be reviewed by anybody. The language is plain, simple, straightforward. This letter goes to financing, additional financing funds. Again, public laws provide for such. Three, Cortex's argument is based on pure speculation. They did not participate in the negotiations. They're unfamiliar with everything that occurred there, and the evidence that they're trying to put on is based on pure speculation.
Mr. Agagy, would you take a side in this matter?
We join with the government.
Okay, do you have any other comments to add if you join with the government?
No further comments.
Okay, Ms. Tang, for opposition. We did receive your opposition, by the way.
Thank you, appreciate it. All right, and by the way, I did provide copies when it was filed about a few moments ago to the parties in this case. I think there's a couple of things that need to be cleared up. There is absolutely no question that the speaker was served with a copy of the subpoena. She claims in her declaration she was not. On the day she was served, I received a call from her colleague telling me that she had been served and if there was a way that we could work it out. So her declaration under penalty of perjury that she was served is untrue, and we can present witnesses if that's necessary. But I'm just making that point because they make an allegation that is untrue. And there is saying that our process server, an independent process server, Mr. Damien, didn't serve him, is lying under oath. The declaration of service was made. So I want to make sure that that issue is completely put to bed. And if there's any further questions on that, I will call a witness. The witness who called me, her colleague, asking about the subpoena on the day was served.
I don't think Mr. Orcutt is raising the issue of defective service.
Yes,
he cites quite a few legal theories, very strong ones at that. But I don't think defective service is one of them. So what I'm trying to say is, although she may have put that in her declaration, I don't think that's an issue they're raising.
I think this is an important issue because they're seeking sanctions on baseless facts that are not true. So let's be clear about what the facts are. And let's be clear what we are seeking here today.
Okay, so let's assume that she was served. That's not an issue. So
thank you. The case is, Mr. Camacho, I think you rightly directed Mr. Orcutt's attention to Exhibit 8, which is the letter dated April 13, 2016 from Ms. Wompat to Mr. Fernandez. This is, without getting into it, it's very clear that it is an issue in this case, the $100 million cap. It's a big issue. It's a big $160 million issue. And I think, as a party, we are entitled to ask her questions regarding why she when she drafted it, who she discussed this $100 million issue with, who and when and where these communications occurred. And more importantly, where's the law about this communication? She drafted a letter that is now part of the procurement record. It's not a legislative act. This is completely outside of her duties. It's not a legislative act. And as such, she cannot say that she has the protection.
Please proceed.
Okay, I'm sorry.
We're confirmed.
Okay, so let's be clear what the what document we're talking about here. There's no protections. This is something that she prepared in connection with this procurement. She's a witness. She says and claims that she's a top official. That's not what Guam law says. Guam law, there is no Guam law on this issue. Now, I can distinguish the cases cited by the government. And I am troubled by the speaker's position that because she's a top official, she cannot be held into the public to testify, requested or ordered to testify this court and any of the court.
Okay, I don't.
The governor.
I know, but I just to specify, I don't think Mr. Orcutt is raising that issue. He says you can, I think the legal argument is you can call a high-ranking official, but there's some additional things that you would have to do
correct.
As a party and that you.
But that's not the law.
You haven't done that.
So. And his recitation of the law, the government's position on the law, is incorrect. There is simply no Guam law on it, and there are no Guam cases cited, to be clear. Now, they do cite to Simplex. In Simplex, they talk about, relates to the testimony of government officials was sought with respect to the enforcement of OSHA Act, and the court pointed out, party seeking the subpoena has not suggested information in the possession of these officials regarding enforcement proceedings that it would not obtain from published reports and available agency documents. Not the case here. we have a letter that she prepared in connection with this procurement, specifically on the issue of $100 million. She has personal knowledge. It's clear she has personal knowledge. That's not in dispute. It's distinguishable. And if you refer to the case of In re Office of Inspector General for Retirement Fund, the court explained this particular limitation and said that while it's not normally is inappropriate to probe and mental processes and motives of the individual decision maker, but it is not, not quoting me, rather than a question of objective legal validity of institutional decision. We're not asking about her motive here. We're asking about facts. Who did she talk to? When was this done? Who did she discuss this with? The contents of this letter. That is completely relevant. She's a witness and she's a fact witness and she drafted this letter. She was not, this letter was not prepared in connection with an official action. We are not seeking her mental processes and motives for her action. The government also cites another case, the State Board of Pharmacy versus Superior Court, California case, for the proposition that the burden is on the proponent of subpoena to demonstrate the relevance and necessity of the testimony, prejudice, injustice, or other compelling reason why the testimony of high-ranking officials should be taken. Now, let's, in the State Board of Pharmacy, the case that was cited was distinguished along with other cases involving subpoenas of high government officials. DeToy versus City and County of San Francisco, the court explained that they're distinguished. These cases, the State Board Pharmacy line of case, are distinguished because in those cases, the high officials had no personal knowledge of the events or decisions at issue. Like in the OSHA, there are a bunch of filings and stuff that happens in the daily operations of the business. The OSHA high-ranking officials may not have knowledge. That's not the case here. Ms. Wompat, drafted this letter and discussed the CAP. She has personal knowledge. There's no absolute, I think we agree, and I think there's no disagreement that there's an absolute bar to subpoenaing high officials. We are asking for a limited testimony. We're not inquiring into motives. We're not inquiring to what she did while she was on the legislative floor. We are asking about this letter, her communications, who she talked to, what emails and other communications may have been disseminated, which we would have if we had a proper log, which we do not have.
I understand that part of your argument, Ms. Tang, but one argument I think that Mr. Orcott raises, correctly so, is how is the letter relevant and how would her testimony be relevant to any of the issues you raise in your appeal?
It is relevant because we are entitled to ask her, the issue of the, there are two issues. We appeal two issues, the issues and the $100 million cap and the government has taken a position that it is not exceeding the $100 million cap. DPW has witnessed, Mr. Beneventi has testified that to that effect several times over. The IDIQ says otherwise, the communications that related to the Kelva Fisher letter opinion says otherwise. She's saying here that you can go over $100 million. It's completely relevant. And it goes to also the issue of the completeness of the procurement log.
I
one other, I think, relevant fact is we have an email.
One second, Ms. Meeker. Please continue, sorry.
All right, so this letter was written at the time negotiations was going on, and we can locate the email. There was an email that shows that it was also provided by Geef's lawyer to Tom Keeler, and we'll be happy to provide that during the break.
Is that the end of your arguments, Ms. Tang?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Orka.
I think she just proved my point. There's other ways that the testimony from the speaker will unpack, which I don't think is relevant at all, but could be proven. We have this email, she says, that went to Tom Keeley. We've got the letter. We could show, supposedly she could show how this letter was treated within the procurement negotiations that were ongoing. She's got all the witnesses she plans to testify. That's the relevant part of this case. This is supposedly a procurement appeal, so the people that would have to be the relevant witnesses would be the ones that deal with the procurement itself. And as the declaration of Speaker Wompat shows, she was not involved with this procurement. There is this letter which speaks for itself. And the letter is, you know, it says in the letter, first off, it's not a private letter from a private party to another private party. It goes out under the heading of the Office of the Speaker for the Guam Legislature. It's signed by Judith Wompat.
Okay, Mr. Orkart, the real troubling feature here, and this is going to take some careful consideration on the OPA's part, is I think that this is a letter written by the Speaker of the Legislature to Mr. Fernandez, who at the time was, and I think the evidence is irrefutable, a member of the evaluation committee for this $100 million procurement. So that's do you see?
But you have Speaker Fernandez available to testify, and that's the case law says. If you've got another source of the information you're seeking, and she hasn't even called Speaker Fernandez yet. If you've got another source available,
Mr. Fernandez, Mr. Fernandez is a witness. He was here today. He's expected back at 2. He's, no doubt, in my opinion, going to probably be called by a party to testify, so.
And he can be asked about this letter, and that's all that matters. Her opinions expressed in this letter regarding public law, which she does express some opinions, that's inadmissible. And I cited the authority in my brief, saying one member of a legislature which passes a law is not competent to testify regarding the intent of the legislature in passing that law. So she's just expressing legislative opinions. We don't need to have her take the stand and reaffirm those opinions or not affirm those opinions. This is totally improper. She needs to focus, Cortex County needs to focus on the procurement itself and how that was handled. And we have the letter, but also it went to Fernandez, and you have that person as a witness. That is the person who should be called. That is the person who should be asked about this letter, whether they had any conversations with Speaker Wombat. You don't just jump to saying that a high government official should be called to testify when you haven't even talked to the recipient of the letter. So this motion should be quashed, or at least this body should wait until all the other testimony has been taken in this case and then reassess the situation, decide whether the speaker's testimony would be appropriate or not.
Yeah. What we're going to do is we're going to take your motion under advisement. With the discussion we had earlier, even if Ms. Wombat was sitting right here saying, whenever you're ready for me, I don't object, it doesn't look like we would take her testimony anyway, at least in the next couple of days. But we will take the motion under advisement because we just, also Ms. Tanks, I just got your opposition.
Appreciate
that. I certainly do want to have the opportunity to go over some of the cases you cited, just like I did for Mr. Orcutt. And we'll issue a decision a little later.
Can I file a reply brief if I think it's appropriate?
Pardon?
Can I file a reply brief if I think it's appropriate?
Can you file your reply brief by noon tomorrow?
Okay.
Would that give you sufficient time, Mr. Orcutt?
Absolutely.
All right,
appreciate it.
That'll give you until noon tomorrow, and that'll be it.
Great. Thank you.
The next preliminary issue that we have is, let's see, so we have that. We're kind of following the LIFO methodology here, so it's the last in.
First out.
First out, so Mr. Orcutt's was 4 o'clock yesterday. This is 3:05. This was the objection to the GEFF subpoena for Mr. Henry Titano.
So, very quickly, we objected to the issuance of the subpoena because one, it wasn't proper. It should have been signed by you. It's in your order. Mr. Agigi signed it. Second issue is we think that based on the offer of proof at the hearing on the second day of this, when there was a discussion about Mr. E.J. Calvo's testimony, it was clear that it was a tit for tat. When you're calling E.J., we're going to call your guy. There, Mr. Titano had left GEDA on April 30th, 2014. He was not involved in this RFP. There's no evidence he was, because he wasn't. Now, the RFP was issued in June of 2015. I'm not sure what the relevance is. If they have an offer of proof, I'd like to hear that. But from what we've heard in the earlier hearings, it seems to be, well, you know, here's a tit for a tat, and I don't think that supports the relevance test required. And that's not sufficient proffer.
Thank you, Ms. Simpson.
Thank you.
Mr. Agnew, Ms. Damian?
Yes.
Do you need some time to respond to this?
Actually, we just filed our response to the objections, and we gave the parties our copy. We filed it.
All right.
Part of the hearing. So if you need more time to review, we can certainly address it, but I can go into the main points now.
Okay, let's, because I don't, if, and I take it you would be calling Mr. Titano in your case in chief?
Well, simply as a rebuttal.
No, if he were to testify, would be during your case in chief, is that correct?
Yes, and really solely as a rebuttal on a supplemental witness in response to their issue. That's really our only point, and it's a point that Ms. Tang doesn't raise, but I think we made that clear.
Ms. Tang, do you, well, before I go there, Mr. Keeler, did you take a position on this at all?
We haven't, but the government would support a subpoena.
Okay. So, he would support, he would join. So you would join in the...
That's correct.
Supporting the subpoena. All right. So, Ms. Tang, do you think you could file your... did you just file
an opposition? Yeah, I just saw this, but I'd like to just point out something.
Okay, well, did you file an opposition to this at all?
No, I filed the objection. This is their response to objection.
Do you think you could file... Did you want to file a reply? My apologies.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to do that, but I think this also... I just saw this about 5 minutes ago, and it's interesting that it confirms my argument earlier in suspicions that this is a tit-for-tat. If you look at
we're not arguing. Okay, Ms. Tang, we're not arguing.
It talks about Mr. Calvin.
My question to you is simply this. Do you think you can file your reply brief by tomorrow
at
noon, and perhaps we can take this up tomorrow afternoon?
Yes,
all right?
Absolutely.
Very well. So we will order that, and Quartec will file its reply brief by noon tomorrow. We will take this issue up at a time to be scheduled tomorrow afternoon. So we'll hold off on deciding that for now. And then finally, one of the other lingering issues here was the issue about, this was the motion for an order unsealing the tape recordings. And this was filed last week, Wednesday. So this is your motion, Ms. Tang.
I'm actually going to be addressing this motion.
Very well, Ms. Travis.
Good morning. My name is Leslie Travis. I'm also here on behalf of Quartec.
You can sit if you want.
Oh, no, that's fine. Thank you.
As long as we're capturing your voice, because you're a little farther away from the mic. Are we getting her? Okay, please proceed.
Is it okay if I put the microphone down, or is this...
It's recording.
It's recording.
Okay.
So we got it. But it's recording, but if it's too far away, although... Our equipment is captured. Sometimes it almost sounds like you're too far away. Faint to the point, it sounds like you're talking underwater. So it would be very difficult, for example, for a court reporter later on to make a transcript of that.
I understand. I'll just hold on to the microphone, and if I need to project, I can project.
That's not just directed to Ms. Travis. It's directed to all the parties. So there is a little bit of risk when you speak too far away from your microphones. Please proceed.
So we have moved for unsealing 5 tapes that we believe were recorded during the evaluation phase of the procurement in this matter. Now, we believe that these tapes were actually made by Randy Romero, who's a GDOE employee, and not by DPW itself. However, the fact remains that these tapes are part of the procurement record in this case. Now, one of the issues that's hotly contested, and in fact, during the direct examination and cross-examination of Deputy Director of DPW, Mr. Felix Beneventi, the parties have gone back and forth regarding Mr. Beneventi's recollection of what occurred during the evaluation phase. In particular, whether or not price was discussed, the prices that were submitted by all the various offerors in this case. Now, we know that they were discussed at some point in the procurement. The question is when. And unfortunately, the procurement record is so deficient with regard to information on that issue. In particular, Mr. Beneventi himself has kind of waffled back and forth, admittedly, because he wasn't present for some of those meetings. So his recollection is he got an inkling, he heard it in passing, he always dismissed it, he can't really identify when they were when the price proposals were first discussed, at what phase in the negotiation or evaluation process of the procurement, and furthermore, who discussed it. He believes it might have been his staff, but it's unclear at this juncture. We do know that it was discussed in the negotiating memorandum that was attached to the notice of intent to award. We do know that it was discussed in two GDOE analyses that were prepared by Randy Romero. That's not in dispute. So the issue right now is when they were discussed. And unfortunately, Mr. Beneventi's not able to testify as to that. We don't have any logs or minutes. The government is seeking to use its lack of a procurement record as both a shield and a sword. They're saying that we don't want you, we don't want to give you any further information regarding when this was discussed, but we're protected by the fact that we didn't prepare a procurement record in this case, or a complete procurement record in this case. Now, to the extent that this information is privileged at all, it has certainly been waived at this point. The price proposals, which admittedly are probably the most fundamentally confidential information contained during the evaluation phase, if it was discussed at all. There's been discussion about whether or not they were sealed, whether or not there was they were opened, at what point they were opened. Admittedly, this information would be confidential. It's not anymore. That's been revealed. Everyone knows everyone's prices at this point. We wouldn't be allowed to talk about it in this setting in front of the media. But the fact is, we know this because it's part of the procurement record at this point. Our concern is when were these price proposals discussed for the first time? And we believe that the evaluation tapes will confirm what that is. Mr. Beneventi's not able to speak to that. We don't have a procurement record that'll speak to that. We believe that the evaluation tapes are, unfortunately, the best source of that information at this point in time. To the extent that there's any concern regarding privileged information that may be contained therein, maybe the government can prepare a privilege log as to those portions. But certainly the evaluation tapes as a whole are not subject to just withholding. Not everything contained in there is confidential. Certainly no allegation to that effect has been made by any party in this case. And with that, I would rest, unless the hearing officer or the OP has any other questions.
Well, you'll get the opportunity to reply based on their arguments. Thank you, Ms. Barrows. Mr. Keeler.
I'm going to reply. I believe the issue of price came up during Cortex examination of Mr. Beneventi, and it's not something that the government has brought into evidence in today's, in these proceedings. Price was an issue in the first protest, and it wasn't appealed by Cortex, and so we believe that price is not relevant to these proceedings, as it wasn't mentioned in the notice of appeal in both cases. In our documents, we've indicated that the information discussed in these evaluation meetings include other proposals, and the procurement law precludes the government from disclosing information with respect to other proposals. The government hasn't waived the other information that are in these proposals, even though the issue of price has been disclosed. And the reason why price has been disclosed is in the RFP, it states that you submit your scope along with your cost estimate. The only thing that was sealed according to the RFP is the 15% bid bond. Again, we don't believe price is relevant to these proceedings, but we've suggested in our papers that we could transcribe the tapes and redact any confidential information that's otherwise protected by Guam law from being disclosed. That's what I have in response.
Mr. Aguirre, Ms. Daniel?
Yes. I think Cortex believes that if it keeps repeating something, no matter how inaccurate it is, somebody is going to believe it at some point. They keep saying, they focus on this issue of price proposals, whether price proposals were sealed, whether they were not. It's completely irrelevant. It has nothing to do with any of the issues in their appeal. if you go to, they haven't raised any issues with regard to the method of the evaluation. They haven't challenged Eve's ranking as the most qualified offerer. They haven't challenged anything with regard to phase one of the RFP process, which is the selection of the most qualified offerer. And it's clearly in the procurement record. The Madam Public Auditor and the hearing officer can go, it's Exhibit H of our exhibits, and you'll see the scoring sheets from all of the evaluators. Nowhere in any of these criteria do you see price as a criteria that is ranked, that is even relevant to the issue of whether or not an offeror gets ranked first, second, or third. CoreTech is just on a fishing expedition. I think the core of this motion, and this is where we join with the government, is that of course, you know, anything that's discussed in these tapes that relates to the proposals, any proprietary or confidential information, should not be disclosed or should not be made available to CoreTech. And I think that's really the simplest way of putting it. And I think it's at the core of really the issues in dispute at this point. There are other aspects of the proposal that clearly Heath does not want CoreTech or any other members of the public to have access to. It doesn't have to do with price, it has to do with other aspects. You know, the parties submitted, I mean, Heath's proposal was this thick. There's a lot of information in there that was marked proprietary and confidential, and the government knows that. We just want those portions of the proposals, Heath's proposal, and the others, I assume Pernix also wants its information protected, not to be disclosed to CoreTech, so it doesn't obtain an unfair advantage in these proceedings. And I think that's the core of it.
Thank you. I do have a couple issues. I'm sorry if it's a little bit scattered. So just to address, I guess, first in, first out, we'll address Mr. Agigi's objections first. We didn't know that price may have been disclosed at the evaluation phase during our first protest. So the fact that we didn't challenge it during the first protest, well, of course, we didn't have this information at the time. I understand that Mr. Agigi believes that this is a fishing expedition. Well, here's my answer to that. Prepare a procurement record. We wouldn't need this if we had logs that discuss that notes who was present at a meeting and what they discussed at that meeting. We don't have that information. This is the only source of information that we have for that. Now, I would prefer not to have to listen to these tapes because, believe me, I'm going to be the one listening to them in the event that the OPA does release those tapes.
I know exactly how you feel, Ms. Pratt. Let's proceed.
So, I mean, all due respect, I prefer not to have to listen to them. That being said, we don't have any other source for this information, and therefore, this is the only source that we have. This is what we're stuck with. If there were a better procurement record, maybe we wouldn't be here. It just kind of underscores the deficiency of this procurement record. Now, I understand that there are certain portions, perhaps, of the proposals that, understandably, all the different offerors are going to be sensitive about disclosing that. That does remain confidential, besides price. And again, a privilege log would go to great lengths to protect that information. The rest of what occurred during those meetings is not subject to confidentiality, and there hasn't been an argument so far that I've heard from any of the parties here today that all of the information contained in those evaluation meetings are privileged or subject to some kind of confidentiality or proprietary information. There's been no allegation to that effect, which is why the confidential stuff, that's fine. CoreTech understands that. Let's keep that confidential. But the stuff that isn't confidential, let's disclose it. With regard to the privileged information, let's make a privilege log. This is kind of Civil Procedure 101. I understand Ms. Titano's argument that disclosure of these evaluation tapes typically would be prohibited by law. They disclosed them, at least in parts. They disclosed these prices. That's what we're trying to get to the bottom of, is when were they disclosed? These evaluation tapes are going to reveal them. Not everything was just put in the packet, as I believe that it was Ms. Titanou who said that. We know from the analysis memorandum prepared by Randy Romero that was identified the other day when Mr. Beneventi, I believe it was during his direct examination, that the Pernix price proposal, at least there's a reference, a direct reference in there, to the Pernix price proposal being sealed. Okay, so at least that, there's no reference to what happened to the other price proposals or when those were open or when it was discussed. But that's what we're trying to discern here. We're at a bit of a disadvantage, admittedly, and not just us, CoreTech, but also you, the hearing officer, and the OPA, and the general public, because there's no information about what's contained in those evaluation tapes. There are no minutes. The government says there are minutes. Fine, great. Show us the minutes. There are no minutes. So unfortunately, I mean, fortunately, somebody made these recordings, even if it wasn't DPW. Now that we have them, we should be permitted to listen to them because DPW hasn't really given us anything else. I have nothing further.
Thank you. Mr. Keeler, are there any logs or minutes of these evaluation committee meetings at all?
Everything's been provided. I'm not aware of any
logs. I'm not either, but you know, in the thousands of pages of what you have submitted, I don't think there are any logs or minutes made. Is that a fair statement?
There is a portion of a log, and the log is being supplemented.
That's still being supplemented?
That's correct.
The log begins on February 2016.
I'm going to grant Ms. Tang's motion in part and deny it in part. And I'm going to order that, and I'll leave it up to the government. You can make a transcript and do the redaction then, but I'm going to order the government to provide either in a transcript form or either in the recorded form. There are five evaluation meetings or so.
Correct.
Five tapes or meetings,
I believe there are three tapes.
Okay, so these three tapes, I'm in order that the government basically redact any information contained in any of the proposals. I'm also going to order that the government redact any information that the parties had marked proprietary or as a trade secret or as confidential or any other such marking. Further, if any of these tapes have discussions between the evaluation committee and any of the offerers, I'm going to order that that be redacted as well, or if they're stating things that were mentioned in any of these discussions between the evaluation committee or any member thereof and any of the offerers, that those be redacted as well. I'll be issuing an order to this effect a little later. How soon do you think you could have in either a tape or a transcript form? However, and I say that I give you those options because I'll let the government decide which is most cost-effective or feasible to do this redaction, but how soon do you think you can have this available?
I have no idea.
Wednesday next week, maybe?
Probably Monday.
That's too soon for this. This is for at least 5 hours.
Well, I think transcript is probably the most reasonable.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yes.
Can I make a suggestion? There's an independent transcriber, Mr. Castro, who everyone uses. Cortec would be happy to pay for it. They could deliver the original transcript.
I'll let you work that out with Mr. Keeler. Okay, but I'm just going to instruct the government one way or the other. But that's either by redacted tapes or by transcript. I'm actually going to give Mr. Keeler till Friday at 5 p.m. next week to provide the either the audio or the original transcript.
Okay.
Is that fair enough for you, Ms.? And if you need more time.
That is fine. As a practical matter, the original tapes are on file with the OPA.
And those are under seal. They will remain under seal.
We're going to
have
to retrieve them.
Because those have the entire transcript.
They're asking for it back.
Okay, do you have any other copies of these?
No.
These are the only copies of these?
They were provided just before the hearing.
We need to keep a copy first.
Yeah, we would need to keep a copy
first.
And then we will return the originals back to you, Mr. Keeler. Okay. And are these on CD, audio CD, or are they on?
Cassette. That was our problem. We didn't know how to.
Okay. Now this is
from CD play.
Yeah.
I mean,
this is from somebody who. This was the peak of technology in my time. It doesn't take that long to copy a cassette tape. Okay, I know that for a fact, having done it. Many, many, many times.
So we may not have the right recording.
And if you need I think we could, at least I have one left.
Okay. All right, we'll give it to you.
Can I ask for a clarification on one of the requirements? I think one of the limitations was that any discussions between the offeror, that would be GEEP, right?
That's correct.
And the evaluation members. So is it just limited to the substance? The information relating to price, that's what we're trying to see. So I'm kind of trying to understand what.
Okay, I know that under the law cited, and I'll put this in my written brief, but generally at this stage in the procurement, because no formal award has been made, none of the proposals are publicly disclosable. It's only after award that only the proposal of the offeror awarded the contract is open to public inspection. The ones who aren't awarded the contract, I believe, Mr. Agee, you point this out at great length in your brief, those are not or never disclosable. Likewise, if discussions had taken place, the discussions are not, you cannot advise or disclose the discussions with one offeror with another offeror. So that's the other caveat there. Likewise, there's the standard WOM procurement law exception to public disclosure for material marked proprietary, a trade secret. I'll throw in there, they may not have used those exact words, or the more common parlance is confidential. I will include that material as well, and we'll start from there. There's a prompt, because I've only gone through at least maybe two of the five tapes. Or two of the three tapes. We'll start making copies. But that's what I'm going to order generally. What the law says cannot be disclosed.
Right. So could we also request a privilege log so we know it's been not being disclosed? At least some kind of a log. So
sure.
And that we further also request that if a transcript is going to be made, that a full unredacted copy be submitted to the OPA under seal. That's fine, but so that there's something you can compare and verify.
That would be fine.
Thank you.
I'll do that as well. The but I'll be issuing this decision in writing, and like I said, the government will have until 5 p.m. next week, Friday, to comply. All right. Are there any other preliminary matters before we can finally start with Mr. Benavente's testimony? If not, we will start Mr. Benavente's testimony after we take a brief 5-minute break. Can we go off the record?
We're off the record at 10:15 a.m. The time is 10:25 a.m. We're back on the record for the formal hearing continuation of OPAPA 16-007 and 16-011.
Mr. Benavente, I'm just going to remind you under oath where we left off last week, Wednesday, is
Thursday,
excuse me.
Thursday.
Okay. Last week, Thursday, was Ms. Tang was in the midst of her redirect examination, and she was discussing and I believe it was Exhibit 2, page 8. And Ms. Tang, you're a witness for your redirect.
All right, thank you. I'm just going to focus on a different issue at this particular moment. So I'd like to mark this as Exhibit 40. This is the supplemental record of the, this is the fully executed contract. That would be 40. Would you mind putting 40 on that?
Mm-hmm.
How many copies do you have? Oh, you have one. Okay. Thank you. Mr. Benavente, directing your attention to Exhibit 40. We recall this document, some of this document. I want to go to the last page, page 17 of this. That's your signature, right?
Yes.
You signed it?
Yes, that's my signature.
Right. And recall you were one of the first to sign this, correct?
I don't know that, but I did sign it.
Okay, do you recall when you signed it, were there any other signatures on the signature page?
I don't recall. I don't remember.
All right. Do you recall a communication with Mr. Keeler about getting signature of Mr. Fernandez afterwards?
It was more, what does this mean? I don't remember conversation like that.
Signed this document, and Mr. Keeler provided it to you, and you signed the IDPIQ agreement, right?
Yes.
And before you signed it, you reviewed it, you approved it, correct?
Yes.
And the IDIQ agreement that is attached as Exhibit 40 to the Department of Public Works Supplemental Procurement Records filed on September 8, 2016. This IDIQ is the execution version, correct?
I don't know what you mean by execution version.
The final version for signature, which you signed.
I remember signing it, yes.
Okay. And this agreement, IDIQ agreement, containing the final terms of the negotiations between GIEF and the government relating to this article.
There are, you know, I do remember in here that there are subsequent task orders that will be issued.
Right.
Yes. So it's not the final agreement. There's probably agreements pending down the road.
This is the main agreement, the IDIQ agreement, correct?
Yes.
Yes. The main agreement.
Yes.
And this agreement would be signed at the time of award, when it's awarded.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you recall, and I'm happy to direct you to the page, that the notice of intent award was sent in, sent out in uh, direct you to exhibit 11. I think it's the middle white line, please. On May 13th, the notice of intent to award. Right?
Yes.
And at that time,
there were attachments to these, to this letter.
Right. So the notice of intent went out on May 13, 2016. Correct?
That's what it says here, yes.
And to your knowledge, a notice of award had not been sent, correct?
That's
this
correct.
I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
This is notice of intent to award.
Right. So that's May 13, 2016. DPW, you did not issue a notice of award to DEA after this, correct?
There's a whole process for that.
Please answer the question. You, as the deputy director, chief procurement officer, did not issue a notice, an intent to award to DEA.
Yes, we did, right?
No. An award. This is a notice of intent to award.
Correct.
But you'd never issued the award.
The actual award,
a notice of award.
Mr. Benavente, just to cut to the chase, I think she's just asking if you awarded the if you made the award to Geef on or about the 13th of May 2016. Would that be a fair summation?
Actually, we have a notice of intent award, which is not an award.
Then I'm just trying to clarify for the witness.
Okay, thank you.
Do you understand?
I go from notice of intent to award, and then we sign a contract. But it's only our first signature. It goes through a series, so it's really not an award. It's really not a contract until the governor signs it, from what I understand.
So, do you have a procedure whereby you would issue an actual notice of award after the notice of intent to award is issued? It's a separate letter.
I think I remember seeing some of those in contracts at CIP.
Right. But did you do it in this case, in this RFP? Did DPW issue a notice of award to Geef?
I don't remember.
You don't remember, or you didn't do it?
Again, many awards, there are different kinds of contracts that go through CIP.
I'm talking about a letter. Did you send a letter to Geef saying, you have been awarded, here's the award? That's it. Answer the question.
I can't picture one in my mind right now.
All right. The contract was signed. Signatures were obtained. I'm referring to Exhibit 40, the IDIQ contract. Signatures were obtained after the notice of intent of award went out, correct? Which is Exhibit 11.
I'm looking at Exhibit 40, and we made a reference to Exhibit 11. Notice of intent to award.
Right.
There's nothing for him.
And then there is a contract document here.
The signing occurred after the signing of the IDIQ contract, which is Exhibit 40, occurred after the notice of intent to award was issued. Correct? But before a formal letter of award was sent to Geef. Yes or no?
Objection as to relevancy. This is an issue that hasn't been dealt with in any of the appeal documents.
Yes, Mr. Keeler, but at the same time, I note that this is a AG supplement to the record, which was filed on September the 8th. That was shortly after our last hearing. I'm going to give Ms. Tang a little bit of leeway and deny your objection. Please proceed.
And just for the record, it's relevant. If we had a log, we would have known whether they followed the procurement log.
I'm going to stand by my initial or my previous order that for these late filed procurement records, these supplemental procurement records, I'd give the appellant leeway. Please proceed.
Thank you. Can you please answer the question?
A notice of award document.
All right, let me.
Is that what you're asking?
Would you like me to restate the question?
Please, because if we talk about a document in between the notice of intent and the actual signing of a
right.
of a contract.
The question,
yes.
The question is, Exhibit 40, the contract that was signed by no less than three parties, Mr. Benavente, yourself, Mr. Flores, and Mr. Fernandez.
Yes.
Was signed before the agency issued a notice of award to GEEF. Yes or no?
Honestly, don't know. You know, if you have a copy and you show it to me, I can refresh my memory, but just to agree to that, I don't know.
Okay, so your testimony today is you don't know if you issued a notice of award to GEEF.
That's correct. I don't remember.
During your, I think the questioning by Mr. Keeler on the issue of the two public laws, 32-120-021, or otherwise referred to as 50D and E in Chapter 5. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, I believe your testimony was that the two public laws
mm-hmm.
for Simon Sanchez were added to the procurement record, the procurement law of Guam.
That's
do you
recall
what
that?
All right, so let me access Exhibit 41, and I'm going to show you the table of contents. Please mark 41. Compiler of Law's website?
Yes, yes.
Online?
Is this your Exhibit 41?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. All right, so you testified. So just looking at this, this is a table of contents. So Title 5 says Government Operations, page 1 of Exhibit 5, 41, correct?
Ms. Tang, what exhibit number was this?
41.
41.
I see Government Operations, Title 5, yes.
Right. And if you look under Division 1, Title 5, Chapter 5, that's the Guam Procurement Law, correct? On page 1.
Yes.
So that's where one finds the Guam Procurement Code, part of it. Now, I'm going to direct you to the two public laws for Simon Sanchez, 58D, 50AD and E.
Okay, Ms. Tang, what's your offer of proof on this line of questioning? Because we've already, at great length, during your direct examination, we went through the public law.
Right. He testified during Mr. Keeler's questioning that the laws were part of the Guam procurement law, therefore they modified, and this is part of the government's argument that somehow this is a new procurement law, and the 58D and
okay, you can ask him how he thinks that or why he
right.
thinks that, but to go through
the
chapter.
No, I'm only going to ask him two more questions and I'm done, but I think it is relevant
okay,
because
we don't have a lot of time. Please proceed.
I will. Focusing on page 2 of this document. And it's part of Division 5, Chapter 58, 58DNE, you see that?
Yes.
It says Makaha Act of 2013 and 58E, the finance design.
Yes.
That's really actually under Division 5, Public Works section. It's not under the procurement law section. Is that correct?
What it says here.
Okay. All right, Mr. Beneventi, remember there were some questions. This is 42. Take a moment to review. I'm going to direct your attention to pages 2 and 3. This is the communication between yourself.
And okay, well, it's Ms. Tang before, just some housekeeping. Are there any okay, were you planning on admitting Exhibit 1 or Exhibit 41 in evidence?
I was going to try to do it one time, or we could do it. What is your preference? I'm
okay.
Happy to do it.
We can do it as soon as he testifies.
All right. So I'd like to move for the admission of Exhibit 41 and 40.
Exhibit 40 is the, well, the Exhibit 40 is already part of the
procurement record.
It's been supplemented,
right.
So this motion is limited to Exhibit 41, which is outside of the procurement record. Mr. Keeler?
No objection.
Mr. Agee?
No.
All right, so Exhibit 41 is admitted. Please proceed.
Thank you.
And this email, sorry, this is Exhibit 42,
42.
I take it? Okay.
Right. So do you remember last Tuesday discussions regarding a question I asked about your communication with Mr. Keeler? And I'm going to direct you to page 3, which has this, bears a base number CT1322. All right, and this is Exhibit 42. And an email from you to Mr. Keeler, dated May 12, 2016. You asked him a question. This question I had asked you was, have there been any instances where we have issued a contract concurrent with the intent to award and there was such a protest, and there was a protest submitted? If so, what was the result? Do you recall this line of questioning?
Yes.
All right. I'd like to direct you to the response, which is page CT1321. And we're looking at the same exhibit, I'm sorry. I meant to Exhibit 42.
Okay.
So move to page 2 of Exhibit 42. It bears base number 1321 in the bottom.
Okay.
I'm focusing your attention to paragraph, the item number 3, 4, and 5. I'll ask you about 3, Mr. Keeler's response to your email. Here they're talking about signing the procurement, the IDIQ contract, correct? Correct? In section 3?
Yes.
Right, and that the contract should be finalized by Friday the 13th. If so, GDOE, DETA, and DPW can sign then or on Monday the 16th. You see that? Then 10.
Yes, yes.
Was to get it signed on the 16th, and then it follows that GIF will sign on Friday the 13th stateside time, correct?
Yes.
All right. Going down to point number 4, the same email, dated May 12, 2016.
Yes.
With two assistant AGs having assisted the negotiating committee, it is reasonable to expect the AG to sign off within a couple of days of receipt of the contract. So you weren't waiting for several months to get the AG or governor's signature. You were anticipating signing within a couple of days of the contract having been received. Right?
At this time, yes.
Okay. And then number 5, point number 5, the signing. says, reasonable to expect contract of approved by AG to be forwarded to ADNU by Friday the 20th or Monday the 23rd. So the intent was to obtain the AG signature within a few days, after Geef signs it and all the other parties signed it, and to send it to Adeloup and have it signed by Friday the 20th, but no later than the 23rd of May 2016, correct?
That's the obvious.
And still, as of that time, no award had been made to Geef. Yes or no?
Probably not.
Move 42 into evidence.
Mr. Keeler?
No objection.
Mr. Agnew?
Just one question. Is this part of the procurement record?
I think it should be, but is this another supplemental document, Ms. Tang, or was this an initial?
This was a document that they produced, the government produced to
okay,
us.
Okay, but this would be part of the procurement record as well?
Part of the original procurement record.
So I take that back. So Exhibit 42 is already part of the record
because
it's part of the procurement record.
And I think that there was a ruling that the waiver.
Please proceed.
All right. One other question on Exhibit 42. Going to point number two on the same email. On CT1321. You see that? Point
yes.
Number two.
Yes.
It refers to a 14-day period where two proposers not awarded can file protest to DPW director. Reasonable to count 14 days from Friday of the 13th. So just to be fair, I don't want you to be tricked or anything, you can look at your question. Say, your question posed to Tom was, Tom Keeler, I understand the intent award is to be sent to unsuccessful offers as well. This opens an event opens a window for protest. Correct?
Well, our experience up to this point has been, yes, that's the event that usually happens.
Right, and you were trying to get the signatures before the, the 14 days after the expiration of the 14-day period.
No. I just wanted to know what my timeline was in front of me.
All right. Last issue here, let's talk about the certification of record. Mark, this is just a statute or reference. Exhibit 43.
And ask the parties if you're coming forward. We still have to secure one wire that's between these two desks, so be very careful with your step as you pass between Mr. Keeler and Ms. Travis. Thank you.
Okay, directing your attention to what is Exhibit 43, which is two sections of the procurement code I'd like you to focus on. One section. It's on the second page, section 5250, certification of the record. Do you see that?
Yes.
You have not, after you issued a notice of intent to award, circulated the IDIQ contract for signature, correct?
I signed the contract, yes.
Right. Was there anything else, too, other than award the contract?
There's other people that signed the contract after my signature, and it would go through the process.
Right.
And it would include the procurement record, and it would be sent to the AG.
Right. And if the AG has signed off, the governor has signed off, was there anything else to do?
They normally would make sure that everything was in order, and if it was not in order, they'd be returned.
All right, so you did not certify under penalty of perjury pursuant to section 525 GCA 5250 of the procurement code that you have maintained a complete procurement record.
Are you asking if I certified a procurement record?
I'm asking you if you complied with 5 GC 5250 of the procurement code, requiring that.
The fact that I signed the contract doesn't mean it's finalized already.
Please answer the question.
Mr. Benavente, please don't argue with Ms. Tang. Please just answer her questions. Just please answer her questions. Thank you.
No. My default answer, if I'm not sure, is no.
Just to clarify your no, you mean you did not maintain the procurement record?
It's the whole process of this event. When we do submit for contracts to be signed, we go through a process. There's other people that sign. Then it goes to the AG. If the procurement record is not attached or procurement log, then it's rejected. So what I mean is to be clear is that we have not issued a contract, so the procurement record in this case will not apply.
Does not apply?
Well, because we don't have a contract.
Well, you were in the process of signing a contract. Did you not? There were at least two signatures.
But the contract is not final. There's many people involved in a contract, including memos, certification, things like that. So just because I signed a contract doesn't mean that the contract is in effect.
But from Public Works' perspective, the fact that you signed it as the chief procurement officer, Public Works is finished that you have, you've done all you need to do, and your signature is an imprimatur that you've done what all needs to be done as far as the negotiation of the contract.
No, because it goes back to staff to make sure that the appropriate documents and attachments are with it, and if it's not there, then it gets sent back. It doesn't move.
And which staff?
That would be our technical engineering staff, CIP people that do these contracts all the time.
I didn't mean to, because I have my own questions to ask Ms. Tang. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I was just seeking clarification on what he meant by no.
So, this is following up, I think, one of the questions the public auditor asked about the record. Isn't it true that instructions to agencies to begin maintaining all procurement emails and communications actually were given on February 16, 2016, this year?
I don't.
Okay. short one. Thanks. Sorry. Did you see the email from Mr. Keeler?
Yes.
To your assistant, Ms. Borja?
Yes.
And I think Arlene Pierce is also your assistant?
She's the controller, yes.
Sorry, okay. So, in this email, CT, page, great number, CT1112.
This is exhibit 44, excuse me. Yeah, 44.
44, excuse me.
Please proceed.
Mr. Keeler is giving the department instructions, point number two of the email, on page CT1112, dated February 16, 2016. He's basically instructing the department to maintain all procurement emails and communication, and to recommend that Eleanor, unless the group wants to handle otherwise, I recommend including Eleanor all emails, including the one you just sent to Mr. Fernandez. Again, we can structure it differently, but the bottom line is all emails and communication should include one person or file that is responsible for maintaining the procurement record. You see that?
Yes.
Is this the first time instruction was given to begin maintaining the procurement email record files?
Yes.
Is this also part of the procurement records, Ms. Tang?
That's it, thank you.
Okay, no, but exhibit 44.
But that's exhibit 4, move it for, move.
No, no, but was it also part of the procurement records?
Yes.
All right, very well, thank you. Anything else, Ms. Tang?
No further questions.
Mr. Beneventi, much has been said about the $100 million, and if we look at Senator Wompat's letter back, he says that there is no specified limit, although there's a limit as to the amount of debt service. Do you recall that?
Yes.
How did the $100 million amount come about? Because that was in the RFP. How was that amount determined?
From what I understand, it was in the law.
I was not
involved in the original preparation of the RFP. That was Director John Guerrero.
Okay.
So they worked that out. Came up with that RFP.
And the amount?
Yes.
Okay. So.
And we stood by that number. And we stood by that number.
So that was an amount determined by Glenn Leon Guerrero or the committee?
Yes.
Do you know? Okay, so you don't recall, you were not involved in the development of that number?
Not at all.
Okay. Who would Mr. Leon Guerrero have talked to in getting the number?
Well, it would be the group, I think, there was a group. I don't want to guess, but it would probably include DOE and the AG rep.
But you yourself don't know?
I wasn't involved at all, no.
Going back to the contract, Exhibit 40, okay. There's an amount set in there as to what Simon Sanchez is going to cost, just slightly under $77 million. It's been my experience, and I'm not sure what Public Works is, but at least from an observation point of view, that contracts tend to have change orders. Is that correct?
That's what sometimes happens, yes.
As this amount is limited to $77 million, I'm just rounding.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen if there is a change order?
It would lessen the amount that's available for CIP and other school upgrades.
Another, was that with the full knowledge and understanding by DOE?
Full understanding and knowledge by everybody on the committees.
On the committee, okay.
Yes.
All right, when you were discussing the
It was mine, at least, I can't tell you what the other committees are thinking, members are thinking, but that's my understanding.
That it would be taken from the balance?
Well, assuming that there was going to be any, we honestly don't want to do any change orders, but we do know that there are situations beyond anybody's control, we have no intention of issuing any change orders. That's kind of like what I'm guided by. You know, this is what you gave us. This is the amount you said it's going to take, and I will not work it, and don't come back anymore.
Who is going to serve as DPW's contract administrator to ensure that Keith is going to abide by the plan? Who will DPW rely on, you know, as we go through the phases,
mm-hmm.
you know, and when you make your first payment, second payment, and all of that? Who's going to, because DPW will be certifying, but who are you going to rely upon to say, yes, make this payment, yes, do this?
That would be, well, the individual in-house would be our CIP engineer supervisor, Mr. John Kalanayan, but you wouldn't also have to get input from DOE and DETA.
Is he a contract administrator? Is he a licensed
He's our engineer supervisor.
Is he licensed?
No.
He's not a licensed engineer.
Well, not a PE.
He's not a
PE. But he is an engineer, yes. As is our staff at CQC, Construction Quality Control, which are the inspectors, and John is directly works with Ray Humio, who's the contracts engineer. So we have a contracts engineer. John is in charge of that whole section. In addition to design and analysis review, which reviews building permits, in addition to building permit section, which issues building permits, there's another section that does actual ground inspection every day.
So, based on your comment, you're going to rely in-house.
Yes.
In-house. You're not going to contract out for I think it's referred to as a contract administrator, you know, to ensure that the contractor does it according to what you've agreed.
Our intention is to do the inspections in-house, yes.
In-house. This
yes.
will
and
be
we
done.
We are in the process. In fact, we've already hired a PE to oversee the CIP section. I'm just waiting for the paperwork to come through.
So would this person also oversee the construction or reconstruction of Simon Sanchez?
He would be the overall, he would be John Kalanayan's supervisor. He would take over CIP, yes.
During the negotiation, and going back to the amount, was there any discussion by the committee as to the subsequent needs? Because there is a report was contracted out by Department of Interior to Army Corps that kind of estimated what the other needs of the other schools was going to be. It was a significant amount.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Were you aware of that report?
Not too much. We relied a lot on DOE, especially Randy, who had access and intimate knowledge of those reports. What he shared with us was that some of that information in there is already outdated. Some of the stuff in the original reports were already completed. So some of the schools that we anticipated being included in the upgrade list may go from priority one, because they would have to be priority two, lower priority, because it's no longer an issue. It's already lowered, like security. Sort of fixed by a CIP contract or things like that. So as time goes on, DOE is continually making upgrades to their schools. So by the time this master plan and the CIP upgrade come along, many of the things in there may be just scratched off. So that would, we rely on DOE to give us that information.
So did at any point during the negotiations, did DOE give you a list of, let's say, their top 10 priorities and what the amount might amount to?
No.
No. So you have no idea what the next top 10 priorities for DOE will be?
It would be a result of the master plan and DOE's discussion with the contractor.
So that's an amount yet to be determined?
That's correct.
Mr. Benevente, how many $100 million contracts has Public Works issued in the to your knowledge?
None that I know of.
So do you think this would be the first?
In the history of Public Works?
What is your knowledge?
This would be the only one that I know of.
Were you aware of any other $100 million contracts, either in discussion with any of the staff?
No.
No?
No, I'm not aware of any.
Any other one? So would you say that this is a significant procurement?
Yes.
If it is a significant procurement, Mr. Benevente, what I find a little bit troubling or disturbing was the lack of proper record keeping for such, you know, a $100 million contract is not a contract we issue in this government very often. And while I understand you have said you rely quite heavily on the professional staff, and to some degree I think that's appropriate, but you are the chief procurement officer of this $100 million contract. And what I find a little bit troubling was your lack of preciseness as to what transpired during this whole time. And going back, the record of the procurement, the date and time, the log of communications, it seemed like, oh, that's the job of the professional staff. But you are the chief procurement officer. Why were the records not complete?
You mentioned that the reliance on the professional staff to do that.
You were the one who said that, not me.
Yes, well, I did. Well, you did.
And you said it repeatedly.
Yes, yes. And I guess I'm at fault there for doing a lot of reliance on the professional staff to get that done on behalf of the department. In this case, you know, as the director has recused himself, I became the procurement officer. The procurement officer for GovGuam for construction is, in my mind, not really an individual. It's an agency. And when you're the agency head, then the procurement process becomes your responsibility, obviously. But there is an institutionalized process in place. And we rely on the institutional process to provide that. So to enter into the everyday workings and to make sure every document is accounted for and every document is logged is not there's also an interesting thing that occurred during this process. Many of our projects have always been design build. RFPs are normally From what I understand by our staff, we don't do too many RFPs. Because we've just been design built.
I beg to differ with that statement, because all of the schools have been design built. JFK was a design built. Because plans were not in place by DPW. All of the schools have been, in the last 10 years, have been design built.
Okay, let me take that back. I remember when I first came on board and the discussion with this RFP, there was actually some debate within the group, DOE in particular, that this project should not be an RFP.
Should not be.
Should not have been an RFP, but we were required by law to make it an RFP. But if they had their choice, it would not be an RFP.
If who would have their choice?
The group, including, you know, Randy, John, Ray.
Fernand, when you say Randy,
Romero,
the
from DOE,
and John Fernandez,
Kalanayan.
Oh, Kalanayan.
Yeah.
That's DPW.
Yes, that this is more appropriate. This is more appropriate in the way of what you said, design build. But we were locked into what the law says, and we even, you know, even the Attorney General sitting there, Shannon, you know, she kind of shared that it was difficult to put this RFP, to put the scope of work together using an RFP process when it really should have been a design build process. So there was, I stepped into that kind of discussion. So my approach was, well, if it says RFP, and you know, and the AG's office, let's do the RFP.
Design build is normally an RFP.
Well, it doesn't have the same, from what I understand, it doesn't have the same law requirements as an RFP that we've been advised by the Attorney General's office in a recent project. And only after that did they start paying attention more to the requirements of an RFP law and the document.
Who started paying more attention?
RCIP people. Because it says, you know, Director, we don't normally do all this, but now we're going to have to start doing it because the AG has advised us that we need to do this based on a project that is ongoing right now in Barrio Heights. And that project was stopped because the RFP record keeping was not up to speed, and this was on a project that was work requested to us by another agency, and we had to get that other agency to provide their documents, including all the way back to even the thought process. How was this project planned? We normally get a work request that says we need a building, please procure, and we don't have any records of how this project got started. We just got a grant number and a 2 or 3 line description, and we sit down and we write up the scope of work. That's normally how it works. With the RFP, it got a little bit sticky because now we're, from what I understand, we're already well into the process. And just now we're being told that we need to do all these documentations and all these logs, and our own people were saying, we've never done that before.
If your folks have never done this before, and I find it incredulous, this email going back as late as February mm-hmm. is a reminder that your folks were supposed to do all of this.
Yes.
And did you follow up periodically with your folks for the institutional staff, as you keep on referring to them, the professional mm-hmm. staff, did you follow up yourself personally to ensure that they were doing these things?
As you notice, I was not copied this email. I was off island when this email happened. I was off island for about 3 or 4 weeks. I'm glad that Arlene sat in my place, and she took this email that we're talking about occurred when Arlene was sitting in for me, and Arlene started keeping track of documents from then on.
But did
including Eleanor, who's our private secretary.
But did you yourself periodically go back to them to say, are you following this? Are you doing this?
I would say that, yes. John, are we okay with the records? Yes.
Did you yourself inspect the records at any time to ensure that it was being done correctly, properly?
No.
Throughout? You just took them on their word?
Yes. I would keep a schedule on the board of when the next meetings were going to come up. And that's basically it, just to show where we are in time.
Was that schedule made a part of the log, or did anyone and your staff, your professional staff, ensure the completeness? Mr. Venti, what I'm getting at is this is a $100 million contract, a contract that's not given out too often. This should have been an all-hands-on-deck type of ensure that we followed the law correctly. We don't give that many $100 million contracts in this government. And to ensure the completeness, the accuracy, and you are the chief procurement officer when it comes to this, and while I can understand you would rely on your professional staff, but it's your responsibility as the chief procurement officer to ensure. And while you may not have been copied, all right, this is where you, during the time you were gone, to follow up what happened during my time that I was gone, I don't want to lecture. I don't want to, because the law speaks for itself.
I understand.
But I am just a little bit mildly disappointed in the manner in which you were not able to answer more precisely what happens in this $100 million contract. And it really casts a shadow for the people of Guam as to the openness and transparency of the procurement process, which is what is supposed to happen. So that's all I have to say, but I hope this will change how DPW will start keeping its procurement records appropriately.
Ms. Benavente, I just had one quick question. Now, Ms. Tang, question you at length about the certification of the procurement record. Just to your knowledge, do you know if one was ever done?
Procurement record?
No, the certification of the procurement record. A procurement officer would have to certify that the procurement record that's required to be kept was kept. To your knowledge, was one ever done? This is important.
We have procurement records.
Yeah, no, I know you have the procurement record, but as Ms. Tang pointed out, and she even showed you the law, there's a requirement for the procurement officer to certify the record, a certification that that record was kept. My question is just simply, to the best of your knowledge, was that certification ever done?
Would that be a signature on a cover sheet?
Yeah, it would say something to the effect of certification of procurement record, and someone would sign the record. It could be as simple as, you know, one-liner. I, procurement officer, certify pursuant to that law that we kept these records. Signature, ready?
I know we have records, but I don't, to the best of my knowledge, remember signing any document that says, I certify that this is the procurement record.
Okay, so you don't really know whether or not that kind of certification, you at least didn't sign that kind of certification. Would that be fair to say?
That would be fair to say. But, you know, this process is ongoing, so.
Well, I know you're saying that, but we also see a contract that
simply require the signatures of the AG and the governor to be final?
But there's a process, sir.
I know there's a process, but the certification, and that, my edification, just to make sure, because there are thousands of pages here, just trying to find out if that certification was done.
Typically, the contract, when it's all signed, there's a procurement record, whatever else documents attached to it, then a cover letter.
I know, okay, but you've pretty much answered my...
So the contract is...
Mr. Benaventi, you've answered my question. I thank you for that. Okay, do any of the parties have any follow-up questions based on any questions? Okay, Mr. Keeler, very briefly, though.
Certainly. Mr. Benaventi, there's been discussions with regards to CoreTech Exhibit 44, which was a series of emails from and including me. This would have been at the time that the negotiating committee was convening for the first time, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And was this also the first time that I was involved in the procurement?
I think so.
You don't recall at any time me being involved in the evaluation period?
No, I don't think so.
The first task order under the contract is for the reconstruction of Simon Sanchez High School, is that correct?
Yes.
Has that been issued?
No.
You talked about your institutional process. Is part of that process you certifying the record?
Yes.
Okay, could you refer to CoreTech Exhibit 26?
Which exhibit, I'm sorry, exhibit 40?
Was it 26.
26, thank you.
Do you recognize that? To make sure.
Not really, but I...
Can you look at the... I'm sorry, I'll take that back. Please disregard that exhibit. Okay. As part of the process, do you certify the record at the time that the contract is submitted to the Attorney General's office?
Yes.
Has the Department of Public Works submitted the contract yet?
No.
Okay. You've learned that the log was incomplete, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. What instructions, if any, have you given to CIP to correct that?
To make sure that the logs are complete.
In order that at the time you certify the record, the procurement record will be complete, correct?
That's correct.
No further questions.
Thank you. Ms. Chang? Mark, before we proceed now, Mr. Agagy, please. Sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Benaventi, if you just look at, I think it's right there, it's Geese Exhibits. It's probably the black binder there. Exhibit binder.
Compare exhibits in here.
No, those are not.
Oh, I'm sorry, Geese, okay.
Yeah, Geese. Those are Cortex exhibits in the white binder. So if you turn to exhibit P, it's a small p.
P?
Yeah, small p.
Is that P?
Yes. And what it is, it's the Department of Public Works Agency report. That's our exhibit P. And so if you turn to page 6 of that report, Do you see where it says Cortec contends that DPW failed to maintain?
Yes.
Do you see that? Okay, now we spoke about it. You spoke about a process in terms of going through a process to organize and get the procurement records certified. So in the AG's report here, that sentence reads, ordinarily the procurement record is organized right before the contract is submitted to the Attorney General for review.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and then it references an AG procurement form 1 attached as Exhibit H. So if you could just turn to Exhibit H in the back of that report. It's probably like 4 pages from the end of that document.
Oh, is still within P?
Yes, still within P.
So you're looking at the agency report?
Right.
Okay.
CH.
Yeah, in Exhibit H it says certification of completed procurement record.
Yes.
Do you see that?
Yes.
Okay, and then just take a minute to review that. And this is, it has a checklist of items that should be included in.
Is that in your exhibit? Is
yes.
That H?
No, this is still stick with Exhibit P. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, and it's Exhibit H within that document.
I see.
The report, yes.
I have a hard copy of that.
What is it? Was it Exhibit H?
Exhibit H,
yeah.
Of this.
I understand where it is.
Yeah, okay, it's further back. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tab 8.
Okay.
No.
So this is a checklist of documents, and then the bottom it actually has a signature.
Yes.
Okay. Is this consistent with your understanding of the time that you submit the contract to the Attorney General's office? This is what you would submit along with it?
Direction of lack of foundation. He hasn't established he even knows what this document is or what a certification is.
I'm going to allow it. Please proceed. Objection overruled.
Mr. Beneventi?
Yes.
Okay. So you testified that previously that the contract was not even submitted yet to the Attorney General for review.
Is that correct? That's correct.
So is this consistent with the understanding that at the time that the contract will be submitted for review by the AG, that is the time when you will assemble these documents and certify?
Yes.
Direction, that's not the law.
You can make that argument, Ms. Tang, in your closing statement. Objection overruled. Please proceed.
Thank you. And isn't it true that Cortec filed a protest on May 27th, 2016?
Don't know exactly what.
Mr. Agu, we have to confuse the witnesses. There were two protests that are.
Yes, the second protest, Cortec's second protest. Well, okay, so let's just go to. Okay, the following page, page 7 of that same Exhibit P. This is the agency report. Page 7, Mr. Beneventi.
Exhibit P?
Yes.
Exhibit what?
P.
Same exhibit, but just page 7.
Exhibit P in.
The same, I'm talking still about the same agency report.
So that would be.
Page 7.
Of the agency report.
Correct.
Right, okay, not an exhibit.
Just the following page after the page
after
that we were referring to.
After Exhibit H?
Not Exhibit H, just page 7. Page 7 of the agency report.
Okay.
I think 7. Just the agency report.
I got it.
Okay. So at the top of that page, in the sentence that begins, because this process is stayed pending the protest determination, DPW has yet to enter all the communications in the log and organize the procurement record. Do you see that?
Yes.
Is that consistent with your understanding?
Yes.
And do you believe that the Attorney General was referring to, with respect to the protest determination, it was the protest that was filed by Cortec?
Yes.
want to explore just a little further this issue of change orders that the public auditor was asking about previously. Is it your understanding that this procurement is really a municipal, it's a lease? In other words, the government is not financing, is not the one taking out the money to build these schools.
That's correct.
Or undertake these renovations.
That's my understanding.
Okay, and the government's obligation is really to pay, to make lease payments, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and the financing, actually, and that's what, one of the reasons why financing is one of the requirements under the RFP in terms of evaluation, is because it has to evaluate the proposer's ability to obtain that financing. Is
yes.
that correct?
Yes.
So really, GEEF is the one, let's say GEEF in this instance, would be the one to go out in the market and obtain, let's say, $100 million of financing, correct?
Yes.
So if there are any change orders, for example, if there are any increases in costs that were to be had in the construction or renovations, that would be a risk that's assumed by GEEF and not by the government, is that correct?
Yes.
Because the government only has an obligation to make the lease payments.
That's correct.
If the government's not satisfied as to whether or not GEEF is performing or any other awardee for that matter, it can simply not choose not to make the lease payments. In other words, there's an arrangement between the government and the awardee, the entity that's actually financing the building of the schools, correct?
Yes.
And so the government's obligation is to make those lease payments, just like, you know, any other, or similar to any obligation of a lessee under that. Is that correct?
Yes.
So if there was any change or an increase in the cost of construction, these so-called change orders, this would be a risk that would be really borne by GEEF, because they would actually have to expend more money in terms of the money they get from the financing, correct?
Yes.
Mr. Beneventi, just one more issue. If you'll turn to CORTEC. Exhibit 13 in CORTEC binder. This is the IDIQ. Okay, so it's page 6, actually, it's 13-6. This is CORTEC's base numbering of the exhibits. And it's section 3.2.
Okay.
Okay, and it says construction monitoring. Do you see that?
Yes.
Just take a few seconds just to read that. Just let me know when you've had a chance to read it.
Okay.
So I just want to go back and just make sure you understand, this is regarding your testimony about DPW's monitoring of the project. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And under this section of the IDIQ, if you'll notice in that first sentence, it says, unless otherwise instructed by the government, monthly construction reports shall be prepared by an independent third party and submitted to the government.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, you may have misunderstood or lacked a recollection of exactly what DPW's responsibilities were going to be after this, after the commencement of the project. But isn't this mechanism of having that's provided for in the IDAQ with construction monitoring by independent third party, isn't this a mechanism that would be consistent with what we were discussing previously, that the financing is taken out by DEEF?
Yes.
In other words, DEEF would want to ensure, of course, that everything that's done, all the construction, all the specifications, all the work that's done is done properly. Is that correct?
Yes.
Because ultimately, DEEF is going to be on the hook to the bondholders who are taking out the financing, correct?
Yes.
And the government's only responsibility is really to make the lease payments, correct?
Correct.
So, does that clarify your recollection about how this project was going to be monitored, that it would be by under an independent third party?
Yes, it would be that, but we would still have inspectors.
Okay. So, DPW would have its own monitoring, but it would not be the exclusive monitoring.
That's correct.
The project.
We permit me to add, we had experience with, for example, from what I've been told by CIP, for example, the JFK project, where there were no government inspectors, and when the actual occupancy permits start to get acquired, there were differences, and only certain portions were released for occupancy, and certain portions were not, because they were not inspected by the government people, and so on.
So there are problems with the JFK project?
Well, sure. You know, I mean, they have the classrooms ready, but not the cafeteria. The cafeteria was ready, but not the cooking area. So we wanted to make sure that in this instance, we had our own people in there monitoring as well.
Okay, so this is for the department's also sort of independent assurances that things are going.
Yes, because when it was finished, we couldn't issue a occupancy permit. We want to make sure that when this project was finished, the occupancy permits would be ready for issue.
I have nothing further.
Ms. Tang.
Mr. Benevente, upon the filing of a protest, the solicitation is stayed, correct? The solicitations, which is RFP process, and the award.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. And the activities of your office, taking phone calls, taking notes, returning phone calls, keeping records, that doesn't stop, does it?
Objection to the extent it calls for a legal conclusion.
I'm going to overrule the objection. Please ask the question to the best of your ability.
Stop all phone calls? I don't take phone calls. But there are other people that are involved in this, DOE and GEDA and the AG. So I don't know what they do.
Okay, so you don't know what your department does either?
Well, the procurement, we're public works. This is a three-part procurement with the negotiation committee.
You are
so
aware.
They handle their own processes. So I don't know what GEDA and DOE does. We're not the sole procurer in this process. We have to, it's still in the negotiation committee's.
Right, and you are aware that last week your office, or Mr. Keeler, submitted additional communication from Randy Romero explaining his memo, the DOE memo, and the pricing and the analysis. And this is way after the protest was filed. You're aware of that?
I'm not aware.
You're not aware of the supplemental procurement filing that your office made?
No.
the public auditor, I think, has a very, made a good point. You have $100 million budget. You agree?
Mm-hmm, yes.
All right. And a change order, is, you're familiar how change orders are done?
Yes, there's a request for change order.
So let's say there is a $75 million base contract. And there's an additive change contract, change order for $1 million. Okay? And let's say the department approves the $1 million change order. So that increases the contract amount to $76 million, correct?
Yes.
All right. So then there's $1 million less for the other schools, correct?
Yes.
All right, it has nothing to do with rents or risks. It's just a bucket of money, and it's limited. Isn't that correct?
Objection as to the ambiguity of the question.
I'm going to overrule the objection. I don't find it to be ambiguous. Please proceed.
We want to make sure there's always enough money for the rest of the projects, the master plan, and for the school upgrades. So we would see change orders in general. We don't like change orders where there are things that happen that may be reasonable and in the best interest of the intent of the project. But we would like to keep that as much as possible, or just say no, we have to do it.
That's not my question. Answer my question.
Say again, question, please.
You have a $100 million budget. You have $1 million.
Ms. Tang, I think he already answered that that would increase the contract price.
Right. But then my question then becomes, the increase in, it's really not an issue of risks to the government. It's simply an issue limited to the amount of the budget.
Objection argumentative.
I'm going to overrule the objection. Please answer.
I don't know what you mean.
You testified when Mr. Ackesy asked you about change orders. Do you remember that line of questioning? And he asked you, well, the government just pays rent, and really, GIF takes the risk. And this is with respect to change orders. Do you remember that line of questioning? My point is, it has nothing to do with GIF risk. It all has to do with the amount of budget. GIF doesn't take any risk, correct, when there's an approved change order?
We wanted to stay, in the specific case of Samuel Sanchez, we wanted to stay within that number.
That's not my question. Just answer my question, please.
Objection, Dave.
Overruled. Mr. Benavente, please answer a question.
May I repeat the question?
You testified that when there's a change order, in this case an additive, that it becomes an issue of risk for GIF, correct? My question to you is, that's not true, because all it is an increase in the budget, less money for the other school, no risk to GIF. Yes or no?
Is that... I'm not sure if I said there was no risk to GIF, but with our thinking was always hold the line on the Samuel Sanchez number. We have the RS means.
Mr. Camacho, can you order him to answer the question, because I don't think there's anything vague about it. I've asked it four times.
Okay, Mr. Benavente, I'm gonna compel you to answer the question of whether or not, and I think there was, whether or not GIF took a risk with the change order. Yes or no, or if you know at all, whether or not GIF takes any risk with a change order, or would take a risk in a change order for this contract.
GIF would take a risk.
That was your testimony earlier with Mr. Agigi, that GIF would be taking a risk, as I recall, but the question is...
Yes, okay, I remember now. GIF would be taking a risk.
Is that your answer?
Yes.
Okay, that's the answer, Ms. Tang.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch his answer.
He said GIF would be taking the risk.
I see. Okay.
Now please proceed.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Benavente, by the way.
On the issue of construction monitoring, Mr. Aguirre, I think, directed you to section 3.2 of exhibit 13, which
yes.
is the IDIQ contract. I think you're on that page.
13.6.
Yeah. I'm sorry, 3.2, my mistake.
Okay.
Page
3.2.
13, CT exhibit 13.
13.6 is the page.
Right. Okay. And under this, this construction monitor is paid for by GIEF?
Yes.
Is controlled by GIEF?
It's their monitor.
And it's their contract, correct?
It would be a yes.
One other question. You said the GIEF would take the risk. You know, this is following up on the risk issue. What
yes.
risk is GIEF taking?
I don't know.
Talk about the lease rents. The government is required to pay, this is on the lease back, the government is required to pay the lease, and under very limited circumstances, if any, it can it terminate or not pay rent, correct?
That would be something that would be handled by GIDA, and it would be the lead agency in that kind of discussion.
Okay. And so if...
You do not participate in anything like that on the table.
Right. And so if there are change orders, project goes over budget, not enough school money for any other school, government Guam still pays rent. That becomes, that has nothing to do with that. Your government continues to pay regardless, correct?
Yes, that's reasonable.
The leases, you have 35 schools and Simon Sanchez. What is your understanding? Is it your understanding that the 35 schools will be available under the lease to secure the bonds? The rental, I'm sorry, let me re-ask that question. Is it your understanding that the 35 schools, inclusive of Simon Sanchez, will be available to be leased to GIEF to secure, under a lease that will secure the repayment to bondholders?
Okay, I think you already asked that question, Ms. Tang.
I was just pretty, okay, as a prelude,
okay,
so
could
I just
you please,
wanted to...
Okay, I know, but you already answered that one.
Okay,
please
so...
move on, we're running out of time here.
All right. Have you had any discussions about whether all 35 schools will be available from the start with anyone?
Objection. It's essentially just a rephrase of the earlier question.
And Ms. Tang, I believe his answer previously was something to the effect of for the other schools, there would be a master plan and there would be discussions with DOE. And that right now, yeah, the only thing on the table was Simon Sanchez. So is there anything else? Because
okay.
this is just
let
limited to
I understand,
the questions that the public auditor asked him. This doesn't open the door to go back. Okay.
All right. I'll end there. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Mr. Benavente, I know that it's taken 3 days to get to this point, but finally, you're going to be released as a witness.
Thank you, Mr. Benavente.
And, I'm going to ask that you not discuss your testimony with any of the parties until these proceedings have concluded, or with any other party, not just the parties here. Do you understand that?
Yes.
All right. And thank you, and you can maintain your place now as the institutional rep of
BPW.
Thank
you.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Is
it Rand back there?
Let's just go.
Yeah, at least.
So, Ms. Tang,
yes.
you may call your next witness.
All right, Mr. Romero.
Okay, can we please call Mr. Romero? We're going to cut off, just so you know, at 12:30. At least get Mr. Romero started.
Do we have a schedule coming back and then just from the...
We're going to return here at 2, and we're going to go till about 3:30.
Oh, okay. I see. Thank you.
Ms. Romero, would you please enter the stand? I ask that the witness be sworn.
Please state your name.
Randy Romero.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give would be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Please be seated.
Mr. Romero, just real quick, what department are you with?
Education. Department of Education.
DOE. All right. So I know you brought a stack of papers with you. I don't know what they are, nor do the other parties, but I know that you don't have any attorney here specifically representing DOE, so you may leave your cell phone and your stack of papers there, but or actually can give them to the OPA staff. They'll hold them for you. Ms. Tang, your witness.
Thank you. Mr. Romero, thank you for your patience. There are several binders in front of you. The one that is directly in front of you, the white binder, is the one that I will refer to as the Cortec exhibit binders. And there are numbers on them. And there's some loose exhibits there, and I think they belong to the Cortec binder as well. Okay? All right. Mr. Romero, where are you employed right now?
Department of Education.
Okay, and the volume?
Can you move your mic closer to you so we capture your testimony? Okay, I understand that. So.
Thank you. And what is your position?
I'm a program coordinator.
All right, and how long have you been in that position?
15 years, I believe.
And have you always in the same position?
Yeah.
Can you please tell me what your job is about as a program coordinator?
I take care of capital improvement projects for the department.
Okay. Anything else?
That's it.
Do you deal with maintenance issues as well? Capital maintenance?
When I'm asked to, yes, but mainly capital improvement.
And Mr. Romero, who do you report to?
The superintendent.
And presently, that is Mr. Fernandez.
Yes.
Prior to holding the position as a program coordinator, did you hold any other position within DOE?
Yes.
What is that?
A buyer.
A buyer. And do you recall how many years?
Six.
And what type of procurement, buyer, like a procurement in the procurement department, right?
A whole range.
All right. Yeah. Can you just kind of give me an idea of what type of procurement you conducted or litigation?
Mostly IFBs.
Okay. Invitation to bid.
Yeah, for materials and supplies.
For the school?
Yes.
All right, and prior to that, did you hold any of the positions at DOE?
Well, after that, I was a computer system analyst.
Okay. And with whom?
With our IT department.
DOE?
Yes.
Do you hold any degrees?
No, I don't.
And just focusing on your position, your current position of program coordinator, do you handle, you testified that you are in charge of or manage capital improvements. So you're familiar with procurement for DOE. Are you in charge of DOE procurement?
No, I'm not.
Who would that person be?
Carmen Titano.
Do you work with her on procurement?
Yeah, on some matters, yes.
And DOE has its own procurement process, if you will.
Yes.
And it maintains records of procurement.
Yes.
And it complies with procurement.
Louder, Mr. Romero.
I'm sorry.
Louder. into the microphone?
Yes.
And that's to comply with Guam procurement law?
Yes.
Is there an independent party that provides that service to DOE?
No.
So who helps or who's involved in the maintenance of the procurement record for DOE?
It would be the supply management buyers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And who would that be for this project, this RFP?
Oh, DOE's not involved in this procurement.
Okay. So in terms of, you're the end user, DOE's the end user?
Yes.
All right. So does it maintain any records relating to the procurement? Not necessarily as the official procurement record. I'm just saying, are records maintained?
On my part, yes, they are.
Do you know anyone else who maintains records for this procurement?
Public Works.
Public Works? Anyone else?
That's it.
How about GITA?
Not that I'm aware of.
Any other agency?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. When did you first become involved in the Simon Sanchez procurement?
Excuse me. If I'm not mistaken, the early part of 2014.
2014.
Yeah.
Now, early part of the February, March, or?
More like that, maybe January. After the first, whatever the RFP was prior to that when it was canceled, that's when I was asked to assist.
Okay, so you're talking about a much, not this RFP, but there was a prior RFP for Simon Sanchez in 2014. And you said it was canceled?
Yeah.
Do you recall why it was canceled?
No, I don't.
Do you recall, was it possibly because there were procurement record log issues? Was that one of the issues?
No. No, I don't.
Okay. Who would know that?
It would be Public Works.
Okay. Do you recall who was managing that particular procurement?
At that time, I believe it was the former director.
Mr. Dominguez?
Yeah, Carl Dominguez.
All right. And do you recall when it was canceled?
Sometime in 2014. That's all I can recall.
And your recollection is a different law that authorized that procurement?
Yes.
All right. So the two laws we're dealing with today for this procurement are 32-120 and 121, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So these two procurement laws have nothing to do, are not the same procurement law that was for what you call the first procurement 2014.
I believe they're related.
But it's a different law.
Yeah,
it's a different law. It's not the same law.
It's not.
Asking. All right. And it has to do with Simon Sanchez. I understand that.
Yes.
All right. And what was, I just want to focus on this procurement. So this procurement meaning the one that is subject of the appeal.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So when did you first become involved with this procurement?
When we were tasked to recreate the RFP, this particular RFP.
Who initiated the task? Who gave the task to DOE?
It was a request from then former Dominguez, Public Works Director.
Okay.
Requested our assistance, the department's assistance.
All right. And do you recall the how that communication was made? Was it verbal? Was it email?
I believe it was a request, email request to the superintendent.
All right.
Yeah.
And do you specifically recall what the task entailed?
Just to assist the Department of Public Works in reissuing the RFP.
So when you say recreate the RFP, you mean you're going to take a template and do a new one or start from scratch? Do you know what do you mean by that?
Well, what we did is we took all the
the questions that were asked in the previous RFP and all the, I guess, other problems that were encountered to try to develop this RFP to avoid those instances that possibly occurred in the previous.
Okay. Do you remember if there were any significant changes from the last RFP to what is now this RFP?
Ms. Tang, what's your offer of proof about this prior RFP and this RFP? I don't think the prior one is at issue.
Okay, that's fine.
Please proceed.
I'll move on. For this particular RFP, there were parameters, design parameters, right?
Yes.
All right. The design parameters are requirements in the RFP, this RFP, that is, for the bidders or proposers to base their cost estimates on, correct?
Yes.
And there are objective standards.
I wouldn't say it's standards, it was considerations.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let me ask you the question. There are objective standards, meaning it's either one, two, or three, or four. It's pretty clear. They're objective standards.
Yes.
Correct? And who helped develop these design parameters?
It was the department.
Which department,
DOE, please? Education.
Okay, DOE?
Yes, with the assistance with the school principal and teachers.
All right. And this is before the RFP was finalized.
Yes.
So this is in the development stage.
Yes.
All right. And do you recall specifically who contributed to this coming up with these design parameters?
It was a committee, the school committee, to include myself.
Okay. Who was on that committee?
The principal and a couple of department chairs.
Okay.
Of the school. I don't recall their names.
All right. And who was the lead? Is there a lead?
It was me.
All right.
I was the lead in gathering the information.
All right. Gather, compile, and...
Yes.
Right. And it's a lot of work to put together an RFP.
Yes.
This size. It's a huge amount of money, huge project. And how long, do you recall approximately, if you recall, which month the actual work began on recreating this RFP, if you recall?
I don't recall specifically.
Do you remember when the task request came in from Mr. Dominguez?
It would have been late 14. Oh, no, I'm sorry, early 2014.
So the first quarter?
Yeah.
Or thereabout?
Yeah.
Okay.
Was it 2014 or 2015?
Was this I'm talking about this RFP, not the original RFP.
2015.
Okay.
Correct, 2015.
2015?
Yeah.
First quarter?
Yeah.
Do you recall if you basically immediately took action and proceeded to engage this committee, school committee, to develop this RFP?
Not immediately.
Okay.
I wanted to work with Public Works to get the structure
all
in
right.
place first.
Whom did you work with at Public Works?
It would be the two engineers, John Kalanayan and Ray Junya.
Okay. Anyone else?
Those two were the primary. And I believe it was early in the beginning when Mr. Leon Guerrero.
Glenn Leon Guerrero.
Yeah. But right. Just basically introduction. Yeah.
I'm sorry. And Mr. Leon Guerrero just introduced you.
Yeah.
To Mr. Kalanayan and
yes.
Mr. Junya.
Yeah.
Did he have any subsequent participation developing
the
RFP? And so you began working with Mr. Kalanayan and Mr. Junya, and did you meet regularly?
Yes, but mostly communications through phone and emails here and there.
So this was sort of a project that spanned how many months?
I would say about six.
6 months?
6 months.
And did you, I know this is a long period of time, do you, on average, how much contact did you have on a weekly basis with Mr. Junya or Mr. coal mining?
I said, maybe probably about two, three times a week.
Okay. Were they mostly, I know you said there were mostly, there were a lot of phone calls. Were most of these communications by phone call?
Yes.
How about emails? Did you share drafts and share discussions about what should go in the RFP?
Yeah, just drafts.
Did you also discuss with Mr. Colinay and Mr. Junio the design parameters?
Yes, of course.
All right. And can you tell me about this discussion?
Well, those discussions were just based on my meetings with the school staff, the principal,
mm-hmm.
on their proposed concept of what they want the school to be designed as, how many rooms, for example, and all the other curriculum requirements that they needed.
I see. And then you took that information, compiled it, and you shared it with Mr. Junio and Mr. Colinay.
Yes.
And who helped you come up with, I think, in the original RFP, and I'm going to direct you to what is first tab one, in the beginning, of, if that's the correct binder. And you'll see in the bottom right-hand page, top margin, there's what we call BEATS number, so CTE1, that's
mm-hmm.
exhibit identified, the exhibit number, and the pages are sequential. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to ask you to go to CT1, the exhibit A. You're probably able to find it faster than I can.
What page again, Ms.
Green?
It's going to take you a while, Ms. Tang, then what we're going to do is we'll break it out. This, I think you have 3 minutes here, so you can confound it and not get very far. We're going to take a recess for lunch,
okay.
And then we are going to reconvene at 2 p.m.
Okay.
This afternoon. And Mr. Romero, so I'm going to order you not to discuss your testimony with anybody, none of the parties, not the press, not any people. Until these proceedings have concluded. Do you understand that?
Yes, sir.
And I'll see you back here at 2 as well. And come back right here to your witnessing. And we are off the record.
We're off the record at 12:10 p.m.
Thank you.